sociology, psychology, political science, economics, and no telling what else. Meanwhile, the British Empire has shrunk to 3 IRA informants, a timeshare deal with the Red Chinese in Hong Kong, and that bed and breakfast of an island, Bermuda. Sic transit gloria mundi, as if anybody knew what that meant anymore. There are, admittedly, things that can't be learned by studying the classics, but education is not just a matter of learning things. There's a difference between information and knowledge. It's the difference between Christy Turlington's phone number and Christy Turlington. There's also a difference between knowledge and meaning. Socrates wouldn't know grunge rock, but he'd know what it means. It means every flannel shirt in America should be dipped in Prozac. Furthermore, there is a difference between meaning and life. Hillary Clinton loves the politics of meaning, and all it's gotten her is week upon week locked in a room full of nerds figuring how to pay the country's doctor bills. What kind of life is that? A classical education helps us unravel these, as it were, Gordian knots. It teaches us the lesson of continuity in human affairs. We read Juvenal's sixth satire. Meantime, she completely ignores her husband, gives not a moment's thought to all she costs him. She's less a wife than a neighbor, except when it comes to loathing his friends. And we realize first wives weren't born yesterday. If we can do such reading in the original language, we can travel in time, go back 2,000 years and find what's inside people's minds, some pretty nasty minds too, such as that of the poet Nicarchus. You should certainly have made a sign saying which was your mouth, which your asshole. Just now, when you were gabbing, I thought you'd farted. And a classical education gives us perspective. For instance, the fall of Rome is a melancholy tale, but careful readings in history show us that we happen to be the people Rome fell to. A classical education provides no skills, but personally, at age 45, I don't want a skill. If I had a skill, I'd have duller work. I'd be a dentist. Instead, I get to pursue that career of the professional amateur called journalism. Besides, the skills I might like to have, getting on the green in 3, pestering trout with lint on a pin, aren't gotten in school. And school is what I wish I'd gone to more of. Much stupid behavior could have been thereby avoided. If I'd known how Plato came a cropper trying to put his republic into practice under Dionysius II in Sicily, or if I'd had a better idea what caused the collapse of representative government in Rome and Athens, I would have been spared a decade of radical politics. If I'd read the mush in Virgil's Eclogue, "For you the nymphs bring lilies, look in baskets full. For you the naiad fair, plucking pale violets and poppy heads," etc., 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 I would have been nauseated enough to escape all sorts of hopeless romances. If I'd been led from Aristotle through Roger Bacon and Erasmus to the Enlightenment of the 18th century, if I'd realized what pains mankind had taken to achieve empirical observation, logical thought, and experimental methods of proof, I would have eschewed vibes, auras, mantras, astral projections, and all the other mental rubbish of the last 30 years. And if I'd read Petronius and François Villon, I would have given the feckless bohemian life a pass and gotten a bath and a job. On the other hand, I liked being a hippie pretend gorilla, writing horrible long poems to Susie and Moonbeam and Babs. I had a great time thinking I could end war and social injustice by letting my hair grow and dressing like a circus clown. And, though we're not supposed to say it these days, the drugs were swell. Such follies are born of ignorance, but I've enjoyed them. So maybe you shouldn't get an education after all. I'm not well educated enough to know. Foreword to A Modern Man's Guide to Women, published in 1992, edited by Dennis Boyles. It's an unusual preface which argues against the work it introduces, but there are some things in life better not faced head-on, and this book contains all of them. Mind you, you hold in your hands an excellent compendium of strategy and tactics. Mr. Boyles and his colleagues are the Karl von Clausewitz of battles between the sexes. But in a war where every victory is pyrrhic, what use is concentration of superior force, flanking maneuver, divisionary thrust, or even a pincher movement on a crowded bus? And that's as if we had any victories. In those rare engagements of gender where the man comes out, so to speak, on top, the first thing that man does is surrender. On another front, have you ever won an argument with your mother? She has bested you in every debate and disputation from resolved we shall be weaned, to the case against asking your first wife to leave her drunk second husband in the car at your daughter's wedding. If you can't prevail over an aged woman, whose every weakness and foible you know, and with whom you've been contending your entire life, how do you expect to do against a team from out of town? And then there is the question of whether publishing this book endangers male kind. The wisdom herein contained is normally a part of masculine oral tradition. These sagacious observations are wrung from the wet towel of interpersonal relationships by hands grown horned with the writing of child support checks. The droplets of hard-won perspicuity are then passed confidentially from man to man in smoky bars, muddy duck blinds, and country western song lyrics. Perhaps your own dad, when you were of a suitable age, took you into his den, loaded up his pipe, looked over the top of his reading glasses, and said, "If it flies, floats, or fucks, rent it." All over the world, pudgy, balding, experienced fellows are telling callow youths, "Cookin' lasts, kissin' don't." They all look the same if you turn them upside down. When the groom farts in front of the bride, the honeymoon is over. But now we have made the grave error of committing these dicta to print. They are not the sorts of things men should ever put in writing, our mothers, sisters, wives, and girlfriends, the last two, we hope, not at the same time, are going to see this book, pick it up, start reading it, and laugh. Because we don't know what we're talking about. Men don't know anything about women. We never have. We never will. Oh, each of us knows a few specific things. I, for instance, know why most societies don't allow women in combat. Combat is just a battle to the death. You don't want to turn it into something really ugly like a marriage. But we don't know what makes women tick, let alone shop. We can pool our knowledge, and that is what this book sets out to do. Even then, we are like the blind men trying to describe the elephant after the elephant has moved to Boulder with its aerobics instructor. On the subject of women, I'm afraid there's nothing to say, and I, for one, don't want to be caught saying it. This business of males and females trying to understand each other is an odd phenomenon anyway, and a recent one. Maybe we would all, men and women alike, be better off admitting our bewilderment and returning to the ignorant ways of the past. In my father's day, a man married the first woman who allowed him to unclasp her brassiere, and a woman married the first man she met who had a job and didn't wipe his nose on his suit coat sleeve. Then they settled down, had children, stayed together no matter what, and were miserable, the same as us. But at least it was a peaceful, stable, unworried misery, and never needed any self-help books written about it. Just an occasional Madame Bovary. The difficulty men have with women is really much worse than a clash of the sexes. The problem is not that 50% of people are females. The problem is that 100% of females are humans. Take a human of any kind or type, whisper nonsense to it, rub its private parts, flirt with its best friend, expect it to cook for you, and see what you get. We don't know anything about women because we don't know anything about Homo sapiens. Anyone who has studied psychology, sociology, anthropology, or any of the other wacko and wog disciplines knows the three great rules of the social sciences. Folks do lots of things. We don't know why. Test on Friday. We know nothing about women. We know nothing about men. We don't even know anything about our own fool selves. Although, if you want to find out some things about yourself, and in vivid detail, too, just try calling your wife fat. There is no cure for the ill this book addresses. The authors can only make a few small practical suggestions. I have one myself. Girls should be given more realistic dolls. Betsy Wetsies that spit up, stink, and howl for hours. Barbies that sag, and Kens that lose their jobs and hair. This would result, I posit, in less distaff whining later on. But all such recommendations are trifling, a mere cleaning of the storm drains on the continent Atlantis. The basic conundrum remains, we are in love with members of a troublesome species. Why don't we fall for dogs? They have 10 tits. Small ones, true, but think of it, 10. Dogs are friendly, loyal, a little jealous sometimes, but not possessed of any abstract ideals about monogamy or anything else. They don't spend hours on the phone or put fuzzy covers on the toilet seat lid so that while you're standing there taking a leak, the seat comes right back down, aimed square at the principal organ of male thought. Dog jewelry is pretty much limited to a rabies vaccination tag. Dogs never want you to spend Christmas at their mother's house, and can't insist on going to fancy restaurants because they aren't allowed inside. Don't forget to bring home a wifey bag. Dogs don't care if you shave, and they actually like it when you leave dirty socks in the middle of the bedroom floor. Dogs do chase cars, but that's better than asking you to buy them one. And dogs never own cats. Dogs are good looking. Their hair is beautiful, albeit they have a little too much of it. But the typical dog probably has less hair in its armpits than the typical co-ed if the co-ed is a Nirvana fan. And that tail thing could probably be put to some interesting uses during... I admit, the dog idea of cuisine is disgusting, but many's the human bride who ought to have buried her dinner in the yard. Dogs smell, but so do we men. And one more thing. The kids are going to be ugly. But when we're out in that muddy duck blind telling our son the solemn truths about how it is between men and women, we will, if we marry a dog, be able to give the boy one truly important word of instruction. Fetch. On first looking into Emily Post's etiquette, review of the 14th edition for House and Garden, 1984. I've been paging through the new, totally revised, terribly up-to-date version of Emily Post's etiquette, written by Mrs. Post's granddaughter-in-law, Elizabeth L. Post. It's a big book, thorough, tidy of organization, and legibly printed. I have no doubt it would be handy if I were planning my wedding or funeral, and I'm sure it contains all manner of sound advice for conducting a new, totally revised, terribly up-to-date life. However, all the people I know have been left out. Muriel Manners, Mr. and Mrs. Eminent, Sarah Stranger, and Mrs. Kindheart are nowhere to be found. The late Mrs. Post used these friends and acquaintances to illustrate her little dramas of courtesy and faux pas. She sketched her characters with marvelous economy, never a word about their physical appearance, inner conflicts, or personal history. Yet they came alive upon the page. I give this example from my mother's copy of the 8th edition, published in 1945. Names legally changed. Whatever may have been the reason for changing the name by which one has been known, social and business associates should be notified of the change if embarrassing situations are to be avoided. The quickest and simplest way of telling them is to send out formal announcements. Mr. and Mrs. John Original Name announced that by permission of the court, they and their children have taken the family name of Brown. What subtlety there is in embarrassing situations, social associates, and whatever may have been the reason. One knows it didn't turn out well for the sad and rather pushing Name family. Reader's note. It is important that the listener understand that Mr. O'Rourke is playing with the differences between the written word and the spoken word. The family name is spelled N-A-M-E, name. However, it is pronounced Name. Hence the reason for changing the family name. Their import business was expanded with vain optimism and sank beneath a weight of bank debt. Today, John Original Jr. is some sort of rapscallion Hollywood person, and the Name daughter, on her fourth divorce, drinks before noon. There are no such adventures in the new edition. The exotic Names have been replaced by the prosaic Milsokoviches, who are changing their handle to Miller, probably to get something that will fit on a Visa card. And that rapier thrust, may have been, is gone from the opening sentence. In this and every other way, Elizabeth L. Post's etiquette is blunt and homely. It contains paragraphs on such subjects as BYOB parties, pregnant brides, illegal drugs, meeting people through personal ads, and unmarried couples who live together. To tell the truth, I already know how unmarried couples live together. I probably need to learn less. Anyway, Emily Post would never have broached the subject. She would have thought it, well, bad manners. Nor would the elder Mrs. Post have held a respectable lady's past up to ridicule. But the new edition of etiquette is decorated with facsimile quotations from the first edition of 1922. Dishes are never passed from hand to hand at dinner, not even at the smallest and most informal one. There are many places which are unsuitable for young girls to go, whether they are chaperoned or not. No well-brought-up young girl should be allowed to go to supper at a cabaret until she is married. Do not greet anyone until you are out on the church steps. Hello should not be said on this occasion because it is too familiar for the solemnity of church surroundings. Perhaps these weren't inserted for amusement, but to show how manners change with time. I found them, though, neither funny nor informative. Instead, they filled me with sad longing for the elegance, dignity, and sophistication I knew in my youth. That is, the elegance, dignity, and sophistication I knew about. And the way I knew about it was from Emily Post. I was a bookish child, brought up in a house with few books. What reading material we had was stuck on some shelves by the front door. One rainy Saturday, when I was about 11, I was sitting on the linoleum examining the spines of a New Testament, a Fanny Farmer cookbook, How to Win Friends and Influence People, a Reader's Digest condensation of Kitty Foyle, a paperback, Bridge Over the River Kwai, which I had already read, and a family snapshot album. It was then I noticed a large book on the bottom shelf. The binding was a deep, compelling shade of blue embossed with the single foreign-seeming word, etiquette, in silver cursive letters. I pulled it out and cracked it open. I think the first thing I saw was a black-and-white photograph of delicate rattan chairs arranged around a low table in a little garden. In the background were brick gateposts with a small fountain visible behind them. The caption read, At Tea in a City Yard. The inviting charm of a garden setting, even that of a city yard, is all too often overlooked. Undeniably true of the yards in the factory town where I was growing up. I turned the pages. If you carry a stick, it should be of plain Malacca. Above all, unless you are a dancer on the stage like Fred Astaire, avoid an ebony cane with an ivory top. Boston's older ladies and gentlemen always dance at balls, and the fact that older ladies of distinction dance with dignity has an inevitable effect on younger ones, so that dancing at balls has not degenerated into the vulgarities of wiggling contortions. Champagne glasses ought to be thin as soap bubbles. A thick glass will lower the temperature at which a really fine champagne should be served and spoil its perfection. I was transported. Here was a world I did not know, had not even hoped existed. Here was a society where beauty and grace were serious matters. Here were people who made studied efforts not to act like fools. I read on. The endeavor of a hostess, when seating her table, is to put together those who are likely to be interested in each other. Professor Bug might bore you to tears, but Mrs. Entomoid would probably delight in him, just as Mr. Stockton Bonds and Mrs. Rich would probably have interests in common. I didn't think I'd be bored to tears by any of them. They all sounded like preferable dinner companions to my two screaming sisters and fat, bullying stepfather. I was only a simple 11-year-old, but I thought I'd get along all right. After all, Mrs. Post said, simplicity is not crudeness or anything like it. On the contrary, simplicity of speech and manners means language in its purest form, and manners of such perfection that they do not suggest manner at all. Simplicity I had. As for the other guests, I suppose not even Mrs. Rich would tell me to get the hell out of the house or go soak my head. The code of a thoroughbred, said Mrs. Post, is the code of instinctive decency, ethical integrity, self-respect, and loyalty. These people did drink, champagne at least, but they didn't argue and back over my bicycle in the driveway afterward. And it wasn't just because they were wealthy, for I found my own mother described in etiquette. She was Mrs. Three-in-One, who had no servants, and must be cook and waitress and apparently unoccupied hostess. Her parties were said to be a delight, and invitations to them eagerly sought. Why, my family could live in this world, I thought, if we but willed it. We wouldn't even have to move into the better neighborhood or on the other side of Upton Avenue. Mrs. Post said, A gem of a house may be of no size at all, but its lines are honest and its painting and furnishing in good taste, all of which may very well contribute as unmistakably to the impression of quality as the luxury of a palace. I resolved never to carry an ebony cane with an ivory ball top to my sixth-grade class. The etiquette book had been a wedding present to my mother, from exactly the kind of aunt who would give a 28-year-old woman an etiquette book for a wedding present. I doubt it had been opened before. I appropriated it to my own use and spent hours studying how to address a duke. Call him Duke. Your grace is for servants and retainers. What color waistcoat to wear with a cutaway? Black. And when to use the cut direct? Never. And I heartily wished the same were true for a punch in the eye in Toledo, Ohio. But the people were what I liked the best, and they came to populate my fantasies. There was Mrs. Toplofty, very reserved and dignified, but awfully decent once you got to know her, and she invited you in for Kool-Aid. And Mr. Worldly, who always had something clever to say about the Detroit Tigers. Mr. Clubwin Doe was lots of fun at the YMCA. And the once-were family, though they'd fallen on hard times, still had plenty of style at kick the can and stoop tag. There were visitors, too, members of European noble families such as Lord Blank and the vague and haughty Duke of over there. None of us ever called him Your Grace. We always suspected these fellows of having designs on the better-situated neighborhood debutantes, especially on the spoiled and willful daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Rich and Vulgar. No one would actually cut the Vulgars, but we were rather cool to them when they wanted to borrow the leaf rake. Actually, certain members of our own set were a bit fast themselves. Mr. and Mrs. Up All Night, for instance, gave parties that went on until after 11 p.m., and the frankly naughty cigarette cold cream was separated and had men friends who drove convertibles. And thus it was that while my boyhood chums were pulling the wings off flies, I was discussing ants and grubs with Professor Bug and Mrs. Entomoid, and handling three forks and four different kinds of stemware. Of course, in the real world, I have never quite made my way to that perfect land of kindness, taste, and tact, though I'd like to think sometimes I've been on the path. I hope to get there yet, but I wonder if any bored 11-year-olds sitting by bookshelf in trailer or track house will be inspired to undertake the same journey by the new edition of Emily Post's Etiquette. I fear not. Book Tour. Essay for Smart Magazine, 1989. Usually, writers will do anything to avoid writing. For instance, the previous sentence was written at 1 o'clock this afternoon. It is now 4:15. I have spent the past 2 hours and 45 minutes sorting my neckties by width, looking up the word Paisley in three dictionaries, attempting to find the town of that name on the New York Times Atlas of the World map of Scotland, sorting my reference books by width, trying to get the bookcase to stop wobbling by stuffing a matchbook cover under its corner, dialing the telephone number on the matchbook cover to see if I should take computer courses at night, looking at the computer ads in the newspaper, and deciding to buy a computer because writing seems to be so difficult on my old Remington, reading an interesting article on sorghum farming in Uruguay that was in the newspaper next to the computer ads, cutting that and other interesting articles out of the newspaper, sorting by width, all the interesting articles I've cut out of the newspapers recently, fastening them neatly together with paper clips, and making a very attractive paperclip necklace and bracelet set, which I will present to my girlfriend as soon as she comes home from the 3-hour low-impact aerobic workout that I made her go to, so I could have some time alone to write. But there is one thing worse than writing. I mean, other than getting a real job or cancer. There is one thing which makes the most nightclubbable, romano-cocaine, post-literate novelist long for a spell at Yaddo, which makes the most drink-addled, free, press, buffet-gorged journalist dream of deadlines. The one thing worse than writing is promoting what you've written, going out on the yakking hack circuit to bamboozle the public, embarrass the self, and exasperate airline stewardesses. There is no more miserable creature on earth than an author on a book tour. Just ask him. Or ask the unfortunate public relations firm employee who has to meet that rumpled, hungover, smelly, querulous, fuddled creature, me, at the airport. The book publishing industry doesn't have much money, and it doesn't deserve to have much money, being run by guys who were too dumb to go into something profitable like sorghum farming in Uruguay, and who decided to try to make a living by publishing books instead. Because the book publishing industry doesn't have much money, when they send an author on a book tour, the idea is to send him to as many possible places in as short a time possible via the least expensive mode of transportation known to man. Thus, the author receives, on a day and at an hour just too late to make any changes in the arrangements, a book tour publicity schedule the size of a Wall Street Insider trading conspiracy trial transcript, the first page of which reads, Monday. Live television appearances, radio phoners, newspaper interviews, and bookstore signings in Indianapolis, Houston, Albany, San Diego, Savannah, Detroit, and Seattle. Air West Virginia, flight 25068. Super Saver double economy tourist excursion cheaper than shipping your pet in a crate fare. Seat 91Q. Warm snack. Leave New York LaGuardia Airport, 5:02 a.m. Arrive Chicago O'Hare sometime next February, etc. Gone are the days when air travel meant sitting next to a tired businessman who spent the flight scribbling on a ledger pad, quietly destroying the value of your stock market holdings. Airplanes are mass transit now, sort of skyborne Greyhound buses, but with longer lines for the bathroom and fewer chances of survival in a wreck. Screaming toddlers and enormously fat evangelical Christians seated next to you fly free. With no businessmen to meet and marry, stewardesses just stay on, growing old and hardened in their jobs. They're middle-aged women with cares and worries of their own. Sit down and shut up. We're out of booze, they explain. Author hotel accommodations are of two types. One is a huge suite with breathtaking views, a king-of-the-world-size bed, a sauna, a jacuzzi, a fully stocked bar, and a 380-channel TV with all-day free pornographic movies. This is the type of hotel accommodation the author arrives in at 3:30 a.m. when he has to get on a plane at 6 the next morning to go to another city. The other type of author hotel accommodation is cramped, musty, noisy, and more nearly resembles the author's own apartment, except with somebody else's hair in the sink. Of course, nobody in any form of media more sensible than book publishing, such as radio, TV, newspapers, and all other forms of media, wants to interview an author. That's the beauty of authors. They don't need to be interviewed. There's a whole great big silly book filled with the stuff an author wants to say, and if people are interested, they can read it. Politicians need to be interviewed because politicians have no other way to get their many worthwhile and intelligent ideas across except in political action committee-sponsored television ads that make you afraid of Negroes. And people whose mothers were murdered by gangs of wild Christmas carolers need to be interviewed because otherwise we won't know if these people can ever hear O Tannenbaum again without feeling weird inside. And rock musicians definitely need to be interviewed because rock lyrics don't give rock musicians adequate scope for full intellectual expression because so few words rhyme with boogie. But authors have had their say and should sit down and shut up the way airline stewardesses wish they would. The people who do book tour publicity schedules are fully aware that nobody wants to interview an author. This is why they accept absolutely any offer to do so, even if it means that the author has to fly to Indianapolis, Houston, Albany, San Diego, Savannah, Detroit, and Seattle on the same day in order to be interviewed by a local Renault Owners Club newsletter, Sassy Magazine, and a high-fiber gourmet on public access cable TV. The first stop in each city on a book tour is a thing called Morning Drive Time Radio. Yo, Hyundai Humpers, it's the WDOA Morning Snake Pit with Boogie Bob Wanzak and Screaming Weasel Steve McMuggins coming at you live from Dead on Arrival 95. That's Hey Hey Hey, WDOA 95 on your dial. Everybody honk if you hate Mondays. I'm sure many people make their book-buying decisions during morning drive time, while stuck in traffic, worried about being late to work, trying not to throw up in the ashtray and listening to AC/DC songs. Being on morning drive time radio means an author has to get up at approximately the same time an author normally goes to bed. Authors do not function well at this hour. They grasp a coffee cup between tremulous mitts and make little bubbling noises into the mic. Man, me and the Stevo, we love this book. You are one wild dude. This is crazy stuff, man. You must have had a real wacko round of time writing stuff like this, eh? Yes. What a maniac! What an insane guy! Here's the traffic report. Booger Bob and Screaming Weasel Steve are, by the way, competent professionals and, when not bellowing at commuters, turn out to be better educated and better paid than the author. They are no happier to have me on their radio show than I am to be there. It's just that authors are the only people desperate enough for publicity to get up at 5 in the morning and have dirty deeds done dirt cheap played into their earphones at 11,000 decibels. After drive time, the author is dragged, deaf and humiliated, to a television station where he's put on one of those local TV morning interview shows, much favored by the kind of local TV that can't afford Mayberry RFD reruns. Local TV is, for some reason, much more amateurish than local radio. I was on a book tour in Waco, Texas in 1974 on the day that the Ethiopian government was overthrown, and I spent a fascinating 20 minutes watching the local TV newscaster attempt to say Haile Selassie in Addis Ababa. Local TV interviewers come in two varieties. One is a bulimic blonde person with a deviated septum and a severe cognitive disorder who went into broadcasting because he or she was too emotionally disturbed for telephone sales work. The other variety is suave, sagacious, grossly overqualified for the job, and too depressed to talk to you. Good local TV people are always depressed because their field is so crowded. There are only a couple of dozen real on-camera network television jobs, therefore the entire industry has to wait around for Dan Rather to pop a rivet so that everybody can move up a notch. Local TV show producers are hired directly out of daycare without much professional experience. A few years ago, I was on a morning interview show in New Jersey. I was made up, mic'd up, and seated in one of those bogus living room places. 10 seconds, said the local TV producer, age 9. The local TV interviewer bounded onto the set, looked at me, looked at his script, looked back at me, and said, "Who the fuck are you?" "You're on the air," said the local TV producer. Because local TV can't get very good guests, they do the next best thing and get lots of guests and put them all on at the same time by category. My category is humorist. I'm not sure why, and neither are the 30 or 40 people not related to me by blood who have purchased my books. Although I have noticed that whatever I write ends up on the same bookstore shelf with Michael Dukakis' campaign biographies and 2 million very hilarious things to do with a frog you just sat on. So I guess the categorization is fair. Anyway, on my current book tour, I was sent to Boston to appear on local TV with 4 other humorists. Anybody who's ever had one humorist around knows that one humorist is more than plenty, or, as airline stewardesses often say to me, "Sit down and shut up, we're out of booze." Having 5 humorists around is like having 5 cats in a knapsack. There was one lady humorist in arrested middle age who had written a book of amusing stories you can tell to your houseplants, and who had memorized her own entire book and talked through her nose so loud and fast that nobody else could get a word in sideways. And there was another lady humorist who was so shy and stricken by stage fright that she stole the whole show by knocking over half the furniture in the bogus living room place and running off the set screaming in terror. And there was Dave Barry, who would be a great guy if he weren't 100 times funnier than me and from whom I stole that paragraph about the types of hotel accommodations authors get on book tours. There was someone else, and there was me. This was not a recipe for great television. Authors would like to go on trash TV and throw chairs at Geraldo Rivera and Mari Povich and Morton Downey Jr. But authors are never invited on these shows because most authors lead sedentary lives and can't throw a chair very far. By 11 a.m., the local TV audience has been driven to Nintendo, and the unfortunate public relations firm employee has noticed that the author is showing dangerous quivering symptoms and needs to drink lunch soon. Lunch will be at a prestigious restaurant on a local newspaper reporter's lavish expense account. You want that for here or to go. Most local newspaper editors consider the book beat to be somewhere in importance between scout meetings and Manitoba Provincial League curling scores. Reporters who are assigned to interview authors are either bad reporters who deserve no better than to interview authors, or good reporters who have done something bad, usually to a bad reporter. E.g. releasing a box of live iguanas during her support group session, and are assigned to interview authors as punishment. Or they are young reporters who are assigned to interview authors because their editor doesn't know yet whether they are good enough to chase sensitive poetic types out of the newsroom with huge green lizards, or bad enough to interview authors. The bad reporters ask bad questions such as, "Can we go to a vegetarian restaurant?" and spend a lot of time pointing out that the author is no Cynthia Heimel, and that this restaurant doesn't allow smoking or have a liquor license. The good reporters don't ask any questions because they're too busy getting drunk with the author. The only decent questions come from the young reporters, who ask, "Is writing really better than getting a real job or cancer?" and "How can I get into something profitable like sorghum farming in Uruguay?" Let's not even discuss bookstore signings, where the author gets to sit at a wobbly card table in the middle of a suburban shopping mall with a large pile of embarrassingly unsold copies of his book in front of him, and every hour or so somebody comes by and points out that he's no Cynthia Heimel. After the author has been to the suburban shopping mall men's room 3 or 4 times to consult the pint of liquid thesaurus that authors carry at all times in case they have to go to bookstore signings in suburban shopping malls, it's time for talk radio. Talk radio is the best part of a book tour because being on talk radio most nearly resembles regular talking, which is one of the 400 or 500 thousand things I forgot to mention in the first paragraph that authors would rather do than write. Also, talk radio hosts are kindred souls to authors. That is, they keep authorish work hours in the middle of the night and have a career that involves a large amount of time wasting and few discernible job skills. Sometimes talk radio hosts have even read the author's book, which is a lot more than the author's publishing company's proofreader bothered to do. Thus, authors love talk radio hosts, or would, if it weren't for the talk radio host's tendency to ask authors questions based on the author's own work. Most authors who are not ladies in arrested middle age writing books of funny stories you can tell to your houseplants cannot remember anything they've written. That is because, if what the author wrote was fiction, it's just something he made up. And, if what the author wrote was nonfiction, it's just something he made up except for the names of celebrities. This is what authors get for not listening to their mothers who said, "Always tell the truth, it's easier to remember." The talk radio host will say something like, "Now, here in your chapter about amusing stories Michael Dukakis can tell to a frog you just sat on, you say," talk radio host makes frantic come on hand gestures at author. "A lot of funny things about, frogs and, Michael Dukakis." After a couple such attempts to lead the author, the talk radio host gives up and starts answering his own questions by reading from the author's book. This makes talk radio extra painless for authors, who can just sit there happily drunk in front of the microphone and listen to someone with a deep, authoritative radio voice read brilliant things the author has written, or, at any rate, copied from Dave Barry. So talk radio hosts are actually great human beings, the salt of the earth. But the people who call in on their telephone lines are strange. Apparently, it's the same people night after night. "We've got Ned from Moline on line one," says the control room engineer, "and Susan from Wheaton on two, and old Frank on three." "Ned," explains the host during a commercial break, "is the only black member of the Illinois Ku Klux Klan. Susan is an animal rights activist who bombed a calendar company because they printed an illustration showing barefoot boys cruelly torturing bluegills with fishing poles, and Frank drinks paint." Then you get to talk to all of these people. But talk radio is still the best thing that happens on a book tour. The only thing that's better is if you can arrange your book tour so that it comes just after Hunter Thompson's book tour, so that you arrive at airports, hotels, radio stations, television studios, newspaper interviews, and bookstore signings just after Hunter Thompson has been there. In the first place, everybody will be so busy cleaning up the mess, calming hysterical employees, having the area searched by bomb-sniffing dogs, and so forth, that there will be nobody left with the time or energy to pester you. In the second place, if you are, as Hunter Thompson is, an author, you will be treated with a lot of respect in any place Hunter Thompson has recently been. "Author, author!" Everybody in the southeast corner of the basement, people will say as you approach. Hunter Thompson is so shy and stricken by stage fright that he knocks over half the furniture in the bogus living room place and runs off the set screaming in terror like the lady humorist on the Boston TV show. Except Hunter Thompson does this with a loaded .30-06 elk rifle and a quart bottle of whiskey on an IV tube and two immense Lebanese Shiite bodyguards. This is the very best thing that happens on book tours, and it should happen on all book tours, as it would restore the macho image authors used to have in the days of Kipling and Gertrude Stein, before the author occupation was overrun by the kind of panty-waist writing program graduates who are willing to go on book tours. Plus, it would give the entire book publishing industry a much-needed shot in the arm, or maybe head. On the other hand, the very worst thing that happens on book tours is that the author gets a lot of attention by knocking over furniture and screaming in terror and such like, and starts to think that being an author is something important like being a talk radio host, or a person whose mother was murdered by a gang of wild Christmas carolers. Pretty soon the author is acting like a star and moaning and whining and even publicly complaining in print about going on book tours. The next thing you know, the author calls up the unfortunate public relations firm employee and yells, "Can you imagine Shakespeare on talk radio with some guy who drinks paint?" Which, as a matter of fact, I can. Talk radio host John Euphus. "We have a knave on the phone from Ramsgate. Go ahead, villain." Knave. "Hello? You're on the air." "Hello? This is a question for Bill Shakespeare." "Hi. How you doing?" "Great, Bill. Love your plays. Me and the fishwife are always in the pit at the Globe. Wouldn't miss one. That's us right down in the front drinking paint."
"What's your question, sir?"
One thing got us wondering, Bill. In the tragedy of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, what's with him and Ophelia? Why does he give her the go-by? She should have maybe helped him, you know, like maybe flirted with Claudius or something while Hamlet snuck up from behind and hit him on the head with a brick.
Whew, that's a good question. That's a really perceptive question. We had a much bigger part for Ophelia, a really terrific part with a lot of meat on it, vis-a-vis the plot. But then, 2 days before we go into production, the kid who's playing her, his voice goes and changes. Left us in deep yogurt, I tell you.
And I'll tell you, I gladly changed places with the Bard of Avon. He's only dead. I'm out on book tour. Speech given to libertarians. At a dinner celebrating the opening of the new Cato Institute building, Washington, D.C., May 6, 1993. The Cato Institute has an unusual political cause, which is no political cause whatsoever. We are here tonight to dedicate ourselves to that cause, to dedicate ourselves, in other words, to nothing. We have no ideology, no agenda, no catechism, no dialectic, no plan for humanity. We have no vision thing, as our ex-president would say, or, as our current president would say, we have no Hillary. All we have is the belief that people should do what people want to do, unless it causes harm to other people. And that had better be clear and provable harm. No nonsense about secondhand smoke or hurtful, insensitive language, please. I don't know what's good for you. You don't know what's good for me. We don't know what's good for mankind. And it sometimes seems as though we're the only people who don't. It may well be that, gathered right here in this room tonight, are all the people in the world who don't want to tell all the people in the world what to do. This is because we believe in freedom. Freedom. What this country was established upon. What the Constitution was written to defend. What the Civil War was fought to perfect. Freedom is not empowerment. Empowerment is what the Serbs have in Bosnia. Anybody can grab a gun and be empowered. It's not entitlement. An entitlement is what people on welfare get, and how free are they? It's not an endlessly expanding list of rights. The right to education, the right to health care, the right to food and housing. That's not freedom. That's dependency. Those aren't rights. Those are the rations of slavery. Hay in a barn for human cattle. There is only one basic human right. The right to do as you damn well please. And with it comes the only basic human duty, the duty to take the consequences. So here we are tonight in a kind of antimatter protest, an unpolitical undemonstration by deeply uncommitted inactivists. We are part of a huge invisible picket line that circles the White House 24 hours a day. We are participants in an enormous non-march on Washington. Millions and millions of Americans not descending upon the nation's capital in order to demand nothing from the United States government. To demand nothing, that is, except the one thing which no government in history has been able to do. Leave us alone. There are just two rules of governance in a free society. Mind your own business. Keep your hands to yourself. Bill, keep your hands to yourself. Hillary, mind your own business. We have a group of incredibly silly people in the White House right now, people who think government works, or that government would work if you got some real bright young kids from Yale to run it. We're being governed by dorm room bull session. The Clinton administration is over there right now pulling an all-nighter in the West Wing. They think that, if they can just stay up late enough, they can create a healthy economy and bring peace to former Yugoslavia. The Clinton administration is going to decrease government spending by increasing the amount of money we give to the government to spend. Healthcare is too expensive, so the Clinton administration is putting a high-powered corporate lawyer, Hillary, in charge of making it cheaper. This is what I always do when I want to spend less money, hire a lawyer from Yale. If you think healthcare is expensive now, wait until you see what it costs when it's free. The Clinton administration is putting together a program so that college graduates can work to pay off their school tuition, as if this were some genius idea. It's called getting a job. Most folks do that when they get out of college, unless, of course, they happen to become governor of Arkansas. And the Clinton administration launched an attack on people in Waco, Texas, because those people were religious nuts with guns. Hell, this country was founded by religious nuts with guns. Who does Bill Clinton think stepped ashore on Plymouth Rock? Peace Corps volunteers? Or maybe the people in Texas were attacked because of child abuse. But if child abuse was the issue, why didn't Janet Reno tear gas Woody Allen? You know, if government were a product, selling it would be illegal. Government is a health hazard. Governments have killed many more people than cigarettes or unbuckled seatbelts ever have. Government contains impure ingredients, as anybody who's looked at Congress can tell you. On the basis of Bill Clinton's 1992 campaign promises, I think we can say government practices deceptive advertising. And the merest glance at the federal budget is enough to convict the government of perjury, extortion, and fraud. There, ladies and gentlemen, you have the Cato Institute's program in a nutshell. Government should be against the law. Term limits aren't enough. We need jail. Thoughts on the prospect of a 60s revival. Written for Rolling Stone during the 20th anniversary of the Summer of Love. There's a stench of patchouli oil in the air. The overrated Old Doors have a hit record. Hemlines are headed up. Sideburns are growing out. People are saddling their children with goofy names like Zach. I see that the peace symbol, footprint of the American chicken, is giving the spray paint industry a bad name again. Oh, God. The 60s are coming back. Well, I've got a 12-gauge double-barreled duck gun chambered for 3-inch magnum shells. And speaking strictly for this retired hippie and former pinko beatnik, if the 60s head my way, they won't get past the porch steps. They will be history. Which, for Christ's sakes, is what they're supposed to be. Who's behind this 60s revival anyway? Is it the present generation? The kids who are 20 right now? If so, dudes, this is some twisted stuff you're into. What if me and my friends had revived the 40s? What if we'd gone around joining the Marine Corps, selling war bonds, and kissing soldiers goodbye at train stations while standing on tiptoe and kicking one leg up? I mean, we weren't that crazy. Of course, you kids don't actually remember the 60s. So, if you're responsible for this 60s thing, we'll excuse you with a note from your mom. God damn it, Sunshine, I told you not to eat peyote buds during pregnancy. But I suspect it's my generation, the 40-year-olds, who are dragging this mummified decade back into public and presenting it to everyone in the cheerful gift wrap of nostalgia. Are we psychotic amnesiacs, maybe? Did drugs fuse all our mnemonic brain cells together like strips of raw bacon left in the fridge? For a purely untrustworthy human organ, the memory is right in there with the penis. Sure, everyone says the 60s were fun. Down at the American Legion Hall, everybody says World War II was fun, if you talk to them after 10 p.m. Maybe we should freshen our recollections a bit. About drugs, for example. Personally, I love the little buggers. But we're only remembering the cool ones, like marijuana, LSD, if you didn't have to talk to your folks on it, and psilocybin mushrooms. What about the STP, the PCP, the thurazine, the crystal meth, and the little blue-green tab somebody laid on you in the park? And you vomited so hard your socks came out your mouth. Then the mood police came. Your face had to go to jail. Not everybody can turn his toes into 10 angry, hissing lizards with rows and rows of sharp little teeth. Quick, help. Grab that chick. She just swallowed her superego. She could mellow to death at any moment. Ha ha ha, somebody left the lava lamp on all night, and now the entire island of Oahu is gone. Wow, man. Which way to the bummer tent? And then there was the 60s mortality rate. Not only high, but bizarrely selective. It was like some evil force was culling the citizen herd to produce a nation of intellectually and morally stunted goat mutants. People who died during the 1960s. John F. Kennedy. Robert Kennedy. Martin Luther King. Janis Joplin. Jimi Hendrix. Four students at Kent State. People who were allowed to live. Teddy Kennedy. Lyndon Johnson. Don King. Bette Midler. Prince. All the other students at Kent State. I could go on, but it would be more depressing than an old copy of Look Magazine's Youthquake Special Edition. Music? It wasn't all Country Joe and the Fish and the Beatles' White Album. The Lemon Pipers were also part of the 60s, as were Vanilla Fudge, Blue Cheer, the 1910 Fruit Gum Company, the Cowsills, Dino, Desi, and Billy, Sonny and Cher, Ohio Express, the Partridge Family, Barry McGuire, the Archies, and whoever the asshole was who sang Ballad of the Green Berets. Even some of Bob Immortal Adenoid Dylan's work doesn't get an A+ on the midterm test of time. Dogs Run Free, Why Not We? Actually, that sounds like T.S. Eliot compared to most of the English spoken during the 60s. Like, can you dig the whole riff, you know, heavy vibes with where it's at, and really out of sight because I can get behind this far-out thing that's going down if you know where I'm coming from. I've thought about this. I'm pretty sure during the entire 1960s, I never once linked a subject to a predicate with a verb to create a sentence that meant anything. No wonder we were so interested in talking to dolphins. We sure couldn't talk to each other. Plus, we're forgetting all sorts of other less important awful things about the era. Crab lice, communal toothbrushes, Jerry Rubin, accidentally picking up hitchhiking Manson girls, brown rice, crashing, women who thought they might be a witch, happenings, getting your bell-bottom cuff caught in a motorcycle chain sprocket and having your leg yanked off, jail, Yoko Ono. But we can't recreate the 60s, not even if we wanted to. We just don't have what it takes these days. There aren't any politicians left worth killing. Everybody's already been famous for 15 minutes. Andy Warhol's gone to the big People magazine in the sky. So what are we supposed to do this time around? All be dead for a quarter of an hour? And too many of today's college students are majoring in comparative greed and real estate arts. They'll never be able to come up with snappy slogans like tune in, turn on, drop out. They'll probably bring their laptop computers to demonstrations and feed in, impact your data interface, optimize networking at this point in time, effect a core dump. Even if we could get the 60s cranked up again, how could we deal with them? How could we read those psychedelic posters through bifocal granny glasses? Free love doesn't seem like a particularly good idea in the current epidemiological atmosphere. And love, real, old-fashioned, L-U-V love, means our teenage children will be sleeping with people like us. Think it over. What about a war? We can't have a real 60s if we aren't fighting a brutal, senseless war somewhere in the butt end of the third world. I'm over draft age, so I don't mind myself. But what do the Nicaraguans think? Are they game? Shouldn't somebody ask them, just to be polite? Miniskirts are every bit as dangerous. Miniskirts caused feminism. Women wore miniskirts. Construction workers made ape noises. Women got pissed off. Once the women were pissed off about this, they started thinking about all the other things they had to be pissed off about. That led to feminism. Not that I'm criticizing. Look, babe, yes, sir, I do support feminism. I really do. But that doesn't mean I want to go through it twice. I don't want to go through those inner-city riots again, either. What with 20 more years of hopeless poverty, crack, and torture by government welfare agencies, they're tougher down in the ghetto than they used to be. We rile this bunch, we're liable to get our asses handed to us in a BMW hubcap. And 62, the story continues, is going to rattle the redneck cage, just when they'd finally calmed down and started letting their hair grow like Willie Nelson. A lot of people out there still think Easy Rider had a happy ending. They could beat the shit out of us back then, and they still can. Giving all our possessions away is going to be more complicated than it was when all we owned was a hash pipe and a set of paperback Hermann Hesse novels. I'm not even sure the Haight-Ashbury Free Store is going to want my Toro rotary mower. And will we have to have more huge fights with our parents? Some people remember the 60s as the age of grooviness.
I remember it as the age of screaming at the dinner table. Come on, we don't want to pester Mom and Dad anymore. They're old. They're sick. They're retired in Winter Park. We're going to have to fly all the way to Florida to shriek at our parents for not letting us share a bedroom with our girlfriend. And, funnily enough, nowadays our wives still won't let us do that. Then there were all those loopy 60s beliefs. Karma, Krishna, helter-skelter, participatory democracy, who knows what. I remember when some people were so crazy they believed the President of the United States was a paranoid maniac who might phone-tap his own cabinet officers and wire the entire White House with voice-activated recording machines and use a bunch of lunatic fringe Cubans to burglarize the National Democratic Party headquarters. Why, if we had the 60s back, some freaks and heads would probably tell us President Reagan made a secret arms deal with Iran and let a mentally unbalanced jug-eared lieutenant colonel run U.S. foreign policy. But don't worry, the 60s aren't coming back. At least I don't think so. Let's see what the I Ching says. Uh-oh, weird hexagram. I don't know, folks. Maybe we'd better get back to the land, set up communes, things like that, just in case. Because you remember what the terrible 60s led to? That's right. They led to the loathsome, disgusting, repellent 70s, which led to the unbelievably horrid, vicious, brutal, swinish now. And that's the worst thing of all about the 60s, the one really unforgivable thing, that has been straight downhill ever since. Current and recurrent events. Jim Fix, author of The Complete Book of Running, died of a heart attack while jogging. He was 52. Among the manifold attributes of God, we must not forget sense of humor. Being a journalist, I had spent most of my career making things up. It was Michael Kinsley who first pointed out to me that the world is funnier than I am. In 1982, Kinsley was the editor of Harper's Magazine, which job he lost, I swear this is true, for not being enough of a pinko sap. Michael gave me an assignment to travel on a Volga River cruise with a group of aging American leftists. Watching this bunch try to put a good face on the butt end of the Brezhnev years was... words fail me. I must resort, as writers will when words fail them, to quoting myself. As we were going through the lock of the Don Volga Canal, an aging American leftist came nattering up beside me at the rail. "Isn't it marvelous?" she said, staring at a gigantic blank wall of concrete. "They're such wonderful engineers in the Soviet Union." I agreed it was an impressive piece of work. "Marvelous, marvelous, marvelous, marvelous," she said. She peeked over the side. "And where do they get all the water?" I had an epiphany. I realized that, for the rest of my life, I'd never lack things to write about. All I had to do was put myself in foolish situations, easy for me, and keep my eyes and ears open. Since then, I have visited 8 wars, 2 revolutions, half a dozen or so local uprisings, a number of Third World election campaigns, which combine the worst aspects of combat, civil disturbance, and the New Hampshire presidential primaries, plus any number of places exhibiting garden variety hatred and oppression, the New Hampshire presidential primaries, for instance. I have found them all hilarious. Humor has nothing to do with the charming or the cheerful. Humor is how we cope with violated taboos and rising anxieties, rising gorges, too. Humor is our response to the void of absurdity. Humor comes to the fore when events render us impotent, and, as middle-aged men know, all events eventually do. We laugh when we don't know what the fuck else to do. Humor is not about a kitten tangled up in a ball of yarn, unless, to steal a line from Michael O'Donohue, the kitten strangles. There's a joke about such a dead kitten, a joke I heard when I was 9 or 10 years old, and it was another 9 or 10 years before I saw the humor in it. A kid discovers his kitten lying on the floor, stiff and cold. He begins to cry. His dad tries to comfort the boy. "Look," says the father, "we'll give your kitten a big funeral. I've got a fancy wooden cigar box, and we'll put him in there on some velvet scraps from your mother's sewing box. Then we'll dig a hole in the backyard, and we'll write a special burial service and say it over the casket. And then we'll make a cross down in my workshop and put the kitten's name on it in gold paint." Just then the kitten begins to stir and wiggle and come back to life.
The kid sees this and says, "Dad, can we kill it?"
The 1994 Mexican elections make lunch, not war. Rolling Stone. I was traveling to Tuxtla, Chiapas, to pester the Mexicans during their presidential elections. On my flight was a group of high-minded women, void of makeup, wearing earthy-hued clothes.